This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckaberry. Thanks so much for listening. Trump on the defensive. Senators wait for things to settle down. A criminal investigation gets formally underway. And are there more shoes to drop? Well, as we head into the weekend, a possible pause in the raucous turnover of headlines, appointments, and revelations out of the Trump White House. The president seems confident that this will end and has claimed as much in charges of witch hunts and dismissals of reporters' questions, saying that the entire Russian influence investigation could be a made-up event. Robert Mueller is now acting as special counsel looking into criminal charges in the whole affair, while separate investigations in the Senate and the House look for ethics violations and conflicts of interest. Two senators now on the events of this week and the future ahead. We begin with Senator John McCain of Arizona, who I spoke with yesterday. Do you agree that the president is the victim of one of the worst witch hunts in American history?
Of course. And I believe that pigs are flying.
Okay.
the president obviously has a belief that he is not being fairly treated by the media. I think all of us in public life feel from time to time that the media is not fair. But I think that the president, never having held public office before, he now finds himself in the arena. And I think he has done some good things, like the national security team he has around him is just absolutely superb group of people that I've known for many years. But there's other areas where it's obviously very disjointed, to say the least.
It's important to talk about the FBI and to talk about your assessment of the investigation. All told, we have in certain reports 18 undisclosed contacts with the Russians during the transition team. Given the inexperience of Donald Trump, does the responsibility start to fall on Vice President Pence because he is someone with political experience?
It's hard for a vice president. I think that the vice president is a very solid citizen and I think a force of stability. But as you know, in the last 48 hours, we now have the appointment of Robert Mueller, who is one of the most widely respected and highly regarded persons, former head of the FBI, who is now going to be a special counsel. At least one side of the potential scandal that we have is going to be handled by him, and I think that that's going to give the American people some confidence. The other side of the equation, and that is, was there criminal wrongdoing? What about these contacts? What was the impact? All of those kind of aspects of the ongoing scandal. And the other aspect of it is, of course, the Russian attempts to affect the outcome of our election. Now, I don't believe that they were able to affect the outcome of our election, but the fact that they made the attempt, the fact that they're still hacking, you saw the latest, we don't know if it was Russian or not, but the whole recent spate of attacks indicates that we have to have congressional investigation on all of that, because we've got to devise policies and strategies to prevent this new cyber warfare, which in some scenarios could actually cripple our economy.
What is the likelihood, Senator, that at the bottom of what Mueller has described as a criminal investigation, that there will be criminal charges against Trump administration officials, and the Watergate term that you used at a dinner the other night could be real?
I don't know. And what I was talking about, it was a bit taken out of context. I was talking about that it's similar to Watergate and Iran-Contra in that there seems to be a new shoe that drops every day or two in this ongoing saga that we are in. And in Watergate, it brought down a president. In Iran-Contra, president of the United States had all the information out there, fired people, got a new chief of staff, went on national television and said that he had made mistakes and they weren't going to make any more, and moved forward with one of the most successful presidencies in the 20th century. So it's not clear how this whole thing is going to be resolved, but we know that it is of significant importance and it's not going to be resolved anytime soon.
If Mueller is your man to run the special counsel, why would someone possibly like former Senator Lieberman be your choice to run the FBI?
I think that Joel Lieberman was the most respected and admired member of the Senate that I've had the opportunity of knowing. He had a solid record of bipartisan activities. It was Joel Lieberman that called for the 9/11 Commission, which became a reality, which we now have the Department of Homeland Security. If you're going to rule out anybody who has held elective office, no matter what their performance is, then I would suggest that you're probably excluding some individuals who might be very well qualified. The other advantage Joe brings is he knows the system here. That kind of experience will be very helpful as the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And he also was once Attorney General of the state of Connecticut. Frankly, I'm dumbfounded by a couple of the comments. Now, the overwhelming majority of my Democrat friends are very supportive, but I've heard a couple, and I'm frankly confused by it.
You are a principled senator. You are also someone who has experienced an airplane falling out of the sky in Vietnam. Has it ever crossed your mind that over the last 72 hours, in all that we've experienced in the last several weeks even, of maybe somebody else needs to take the controls here? And have you thought about yourself?
You know, that's an excellent question. I believe that I can continue to make a contribution, and the honor of being able to serve is something that I kind of wonder at every single day.
Senator John McCain, thank you so much.
Always great to talk to you. Thanks again.
From an outspoken Arizona Senator John McCain, we spoke with Oregon Democrat Senator Ron Wyden, who sits on the Senate Intelligence Committee. He believes that the Mueller special counsel appointment is the big headline of the week.
It certainly is a strong step in the right direction. Look, I've disagreed with Bob Mueller over the years on issues, particularly some of his views with respect to surveillance, the government surveillance of law-abiding Americans. Yet I've always considered him to be a professional and an honorable person. And obviously, we've got to continue with our investigation. At the Intelligence Committee, I'm leading the effort to ensure that we really follow the money here. Because if you go all the way back to the Trump family in 2008, they said point blank, and that was a time when it was hard to get money, a significant amount of their portfolio involved Russian investments.
And do you think with the 18 reported undisclosed contacts between Trump officials and Russian officials during the transition and shortly after constitutes a cavalier attitude about security that may conceivably be impeachable?
Well, first of all, I think there are a lot of unanswered questions with respect to the transition, and I'm glad you asked about it. You know, I think people need to remember that the vice president, Mike Pence, was head of Trump's transition when Michael Flynn, for example, was hired. And as you know, Sally Yates said the other day before the Congress that she was concerned that Flynn was at risk of being blackmailed by the Russians. So there are a whole host of issues that relate to the transition, you know, number one, and it involves a variety of individuals.
So, Senator, as an outsider, Donald Trump might be excused for not crossing the T's and dotting all of the I's, but I suspect you're less inclined to forgive Vice President Pence if he was told that blackmail was possible in the Flynn case while he was National Security Advisor, and just ignoring all of that.
Well, let's put it real simply. The Vice President is certainly not going to be able to say he's an outsider. Now, we've had a whole variety of sources anonymously out and about saying the vice president didn't know anything about these kinds of ties that I just mentioned with respect to Mike Flynn. But there are news stories going back to last summer about Flynn's dicey foreign ties. So there's something of a pattern among officials in this administration. CIA Director Mike Pompeo denied to me at an open Intelligence Committee hearing about any knowledge of Flynn and Russia. And so some of these comments, in my view, just don't pass the smell test.
What do you think is the most likely scenario, that a bipartisan coalition will emerge to actually push a change in administrations here in the case of, say, Watergate, as the comparison was made by Senator McCain?
I believe that's getting out in front of where things are right now. There's a lot of important work to do to actually find the facts. For example, about an hour after the president had, in effect, fired Comey, I made it clear that I thought it was extraordinarily important that Director Comey come before the Senate Intelligence Committee in an open session to answer, I think, fundamental questions.
All right. So, Senator, you say don't get out in front, but you're the out front guy in the Senate. I mean, you're the one that certainly Democrats rely on to hear first where things could possibly be headed and the scenarios that are maybe most alarming. I think the American people, Republican and Democrat, are impatient with this and want someone out front to describe where this can go and how we can move forward and under what circumstances we will move forward. Is that an unfair request?
Not at all. And I am at this day in and day out trying to make sure that Americans know where things are and what the next steps are. I've had 37 town hall meetings so far this year. I don't think anybody has been more visible out and out in front of their constituents at home. And let me kind of give you my assessment of exactly where things are. When you have the president, in his own words, firing the FBI director to end an investigation into his campaign, I believe that is an attack on our democratic institutions. And if you just go based on what the president admitted on national television, it looks, you know, pretty grim. And now we're going to have a special counsel. I think that's an important step. We're going to continue with our hearings. And in the Intelligence Committee, I've led the fight to have more of those out in the open so you and the American people can actually get a sense of what is happening. I will not on my watch let this be bottled up in a bunch of closed committee meetings.
Senator Ron Wyden sits on the Senate Intelligence Committee. Thank you so much, sir.
Thanks for having me. Bye now.
The symbolism will be great, but possibly in exact reverse measure to the visit President Obama made to the Islamic world early in his presidency. President Trump makes a speech in Saudi Arabia, the centerpiece of his religion-themed first overseas trip as president. 9 days. We'll see him in Saudi Arabia, Israel, Belgium, Italy, and the Vatican. Trump will get a royal welcome on his first stop in Saudi Arabia, where among the celebratory events are the Arab Islamic American Summit. 37 heads of state and at least 6 prime ministers are set to attend. A Saudi brand new global center for combating extremist ideology will be the venue where Trump will address the, quote, need to confront radical ideology and the president's hopes for a peaceful vision of Islam to dominate across the world. That's what National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster gave as a preview to reporters this week. The speech is to be written by White House Senior Policy Advisor Stephen Miller, who was the chief architect of Trump's travel ban targeting Muslim-majority countries. Shadi Hamid is Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institute and author of the book Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. Shadi, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Would you say that there is a sort of, yin and yang to President Obama's visit to the Islamic world in Cairo and this visit of President Trump in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, so President Obama came into it with considerable knowledge of Islam and Muslims. He had obviously grown up for part of his life in a Muslim-majority country, Indonesia. Trump is almost the exact opposite of that. You know, as you suggested, in that he's a deeply irreligious person. He's never, up until this point in his life, shown much interest in religion. And not only that, that in some ways, Trump is our first openly Islamophobic president. I mean, it's hard to remember it now, but during the campaign, Trump actually said, quote unquote, I think Islam hates us. So for him now to go and to give a speech about Islam, I mean, it almost sounds like something out of a movie. Is this really happening? And it's also, I think, a little bit odd that an American president would give a speech about Islam. Would we ever expect Donald Trump to give a speech about Christianity. So it's an awkward position for him to be in. That said, because of his Islamophobic past, I think the expectations are quite low. And I think it's at least somewhat positive that, at least according to H.R. McMaster, this speech is supposed to be inclusive of Islam. So the idea here being that Islam, Christianity, and Judaism have a common civilizational front against extremism. So at least Islam is being included in that positive grouping of religions.
If your mission was to keep the president from departing from script and making this speech the occasion of a full-blown international incident of one kind or another, what language would you advise him to avoid? What things would you advise him to avoid? Are there fences to be mended here? What would you say to the president?
So, I mean, well, the good thing here is that Trump will be reading off of a prepared speech that will have been kind of signed off on and approved and looked at by a number of different aides, and not just obviously the very controversial aide, Stephen Miller. So that's good, and we just hope that Trump won't ad-lib too much. I think that what you'll end up hearing is a lot of platitudes and cliches, and unfortunately that's oftentimes what happens when senior officials talk about Islam. So promoting moderation, tolerance, religions coming together, extremism being a problem that we can all agree is a problem. You know, that said, there is this, I think, there's always this problem of the cliched approach of saying, oh, if only Muslims were more moderate, if only more Muslims spoke out against extremism. That kind of language is always going to be problematic because it's patronizing. And it also suggests that Muslims aren't already, quote unquote, moderate, that Muslims haven't spoken up against extremism when they have endlessly when it comes to groups like ISIS. So I think that we'll hear that, and that's a problem that other presidents have fallen into, including President Obama. But because the expectations are so low, as I mentioned, that's still, to me, an improvement, you know? So that's one thing. I think the other challenge here is that Trump is giving this speech in Saudi Arabia. And when you think about it, that's kind of an odd venue to give a speech about promoting tolerance and moderation, because Saudi Arabia is one of the world's only theocracies. No one would argue that Saudi Arabia is a model of pluralism and tolerance. So he sort of has to, you know, thread a difficult needle there. He needs to sort of hint at the problem of promoting religious hatred or promoting sectarianism without offending too directly his Saudi hosts. I mean, that's a challenge for anyone to do.
Well, because of the special relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States, there's another way of looking at this speech and the pitfalls. I mean, one could certainly look at this title, The Need to Confront Radical Ideology, and outline a speech that would take Saudi Arabia to task for certain things that it does need to be held accountable for on this. What might those be? And I guess we can be fairly confident that the president will go nowhere near any of it.
You know, exactly. Yeah. So if you had that title of a speech and you were doing it somewhere else, then you could imagine Saudi Arabia being a main target. I mean, Saudi Arabia has used its considerable funding and resources to promote a harsh and strict interpretation of Islam throughout the Muslim world. We all know that that's the case. There's talk about, you know, is the new Saudi leadership interested in reform, of making slow steps in the right direction? So I think that what Trump would want to do ideally is to not be too overtly critical in any way, but sort of encourage Saudi Arabia to continue moving along this course. I mean, the Saudis, for their part, are excited about Trump. They see Trump as an improvement over Obama for a number of different reasons. So Trump can say, well, listen, I'm with you when it comes to confronting Iran, but I would want you to make at least some more progress in not promoting too much sectarianism or problematic religious messages abroad. So I think that that's the kind of understanding that you'd ideally want to have.
Shadi Hamid is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, author of the book Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. Shadi, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
This week, the police officer in the September 2016 Tulsa, Oklahoma shooting of unarmed 40-year-old Terrence Crutcher was found not guilty of manslaughter. Betty Shelby, who is white, was acquitted by a jury of 8 women and 4 men, 9 of them white, 3 black, who deliberated for 9 hours before reaching their verdict. Protests were immediate but remained peaceful in the wake of statements calling for calm from Governor Fallon. Activists who called the verdict a blow to the black community and family members of Crutcher, who said Officer Shelby got away with murder. The case, for people in the courtroom and for the citizens of Tulsa, comes back to police video of the incident in which you could partially hear the unfolding of events.
I've got a feeling that's about to happen.
That looks like a bad dude, too, to be honest with them.
Which way are they facing?
Police one, they're facing westbound. I think he may have just been tasered.
Shots fired!
In the video, Crutcher can be seen walking away from Officer Shelby with his hands in the air before being tasered by another officer and then shot dead by Shelby as he lay on the ground. Michelle Brown is program coordinator at the Greenwood Cultural Center. Michelle, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hello.
So the circumstances from the video are very much in the minds of people in Tulsa. What's the feeling on the street?
The feeling is that she got away with murder. The feeling is that he had committed no crime, his vehicle had broken down in the middle of the street, and that she was quick to shoot and kill him when she should have shot her taser as the other officer did. The feeling is that she is a murderer and she got away with murder.
She says she shot out of fear, and among the evidence presented in court was forensics that PCP was both in the car and was evident in Mr. Crutcher's blood. How does that in any way change the circumstances?
It does not actually change the circumstances because he was walking away with his hands in the air, because every person that they have stopped that they've suspected may be on a drug has not ended up shot dead.
And in terms of the community, this entire incident since 2016 has stirred up some painful history for people in Tulsa. How have you monitored that, and how have you attempted to keep this event from causing those painful memories to become present day outbursts of racial violence?
Well, we're all too aware of the fact that a racial divide still exists in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We still have not healed from the events of the 1921 Tulsa massacre that occurred here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And we realize, we believe that race definitely had something to do with her actions. And that's one of the things that Tulsa has to come to grips with. Even our mayor, G.T. Bynum, in an interview that he did yesterday, said that that's our greatest issue, is the racism and the racial divide that exists in Tulsa today. So that played a big part in, I believe, Betty Shelby's actions and the response of the community, both black and white. We saw several posts yesterday by white men who referenced the race riot, as they refer to it, and said that we know they're not going to riot because they remember what happened. And if they've forgotten, maybe we need to remind them.
As we've seen around the nation in incidents like this, the courtroom is not the best place for a process of reconciliation between members of the black and white community on issues of police violence. What efforts need to be taken in the community, independent of this verdict, to get police to know the black community better, to create bridges of communication, those sorts of things that have been started in other communities around the country?
I think that the police need to be proactive in improving and in repairing the relationships between blacks and the police department. And something that they've been talking about doing since Drew Diamond was police chief is community policing. We want better training for the officers. We want all of the officers equipped with body cameras that should be on at all times. And those are some things that we have to see happening now. We're tired of excuses about why it can't happen and why it's going to take longer. We want to see change now. And I think that we as a community must continue to address these issues and fight for what we believe is are things that are going to really make a difference. And community policing is key.
The change in leadership at the White House and the fact that Oklahoma was very supportive of Donald Trump, I'm wondering if the political environment explains some of those really painful comments that you described earlier referencing the 1921 riots.
Well, they were doing that when Obama was in office. I think Trump being elected with his racist views and attitude has made some people feel a little more courageous. It's not that they didn't feel that way before he was elected, but now they're part of a bigger group. And so they're much more vocal about their opinions and their attitudes, especially towards African-Americans. And so in that way, yes, the very people that are making the laws and enforcing the laws seem to share many of those racist views and attitudes.
But locally, there's reason for optimism because of the proactive work of the new Republican mayor, G.T. Bynum.
Our community is tired and they've become more involved within the past couple of years, more involved in politics, more involved in local elections, more involved in what's going on in the city council. And so we have a new city council representative. We have a new state senator and state representative. So we're seeing change throughout our community as we work towards being proactive and being a part of the solution.
Michelle Brown is program coordinator at the Greenwood Cultural Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Michelle, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Iranians have an election that will test the Trump influence in the Middle East in a very different way than his overseas trip to Saudi Arabia. Will Iranians stay the course with current president, moderate cleric Hassan Rouhani, or choose hardline conservatives, among them Ibrahim Raisi? The popular nuclear deal in Iran is part of the campaign, as well as fears that it may be threatened by President Trump, who criticized it on the campaign trail. Trita Parsi of the National Iranian American Council says the people are speaking mostly about their hopes for an improving economy, and they may be inclined to punish anyone they see getting in the way of that economic growth.
All the polls show that Rouhani is doing quite well. However, if a major surprise happens or if the turnout ends up being rather low, then there is a risk that Rouhani would lose. And part of the reason why the turnout could end up being low is that despite the fact that the population clearly seems to want to have greater openness, there is disappointment that the nuclear deal has not yielded the economic benefits that people had anticipated.
And there, I suspect, is worry about President Trump in that regard.
That is a very big reason as to why the economic benefits have not come through, because a lot of international businesses who would like to invest in Iran are very much afraid of doing so because they fear that President Trump is going to reimpose sanctions and undo the nuclear deal. And they're not in the mood of having to pay the cost of going into Iran and then having to leave it again, because that's both embarrassing for these companies, but also very financially costly.
And is there a domestic issue that is dominating the electoral campaign?
More than anything else, it is the economy. And that's what the hardliner is very interesting. The hardline candidate, Ibrahim Raisi, has actually avoided many of these cultural issues, the more socially conservative issues that people of his party or his orientation have tended to focus on, and instead zeroed in very much on the idea that Rouhani has failed on the economy and that he was naive signing this nuclear deal and essentially has ended up giving up so much of Iran's strategic assets without getting much in return. Having said that, I think it's important to also note that while all of the Republican candidates in the U.S. all opposed the nuclear deal and said that they would either tear it up on day one or try to renegotiate it, the conservatives in Iran have criticized the deal, but all of them have said that they would respect and adhere to it.
In terms of the Iranian economy, have oil prices helped or hurt the available hard currency from the oil business?
Well, oil prices have dropped quite significantly, so the oil income that the Iranians could have expected have been lower. But on the other hand, the Iranians have started pumping up much more oil and they have regained their market shares to a very large extent. In fact, this year alone, IMF is predicting that Iran will have a 6.6% growth, which is quite significant. However, almost all of that growth is driven by oil sales. And there's a problem with that. The oil industry is controlled by the state, which means that all of the money is going to the state. This is not benefiting the private sector in Iran, and it's the private sector that could help create new jobs. So as a result, there is more money coming in. The economy is growing, but average people are not feeling it.
Does Ibrahim Raisi, the hardliner and the challenger in this case, have the support of the supreme leader and the always expected to be hardline clergy?
He certainly wants to give the impression that he is the candidate favored by Khamenei. But what is fascinating here is that the candidate that has been favored or who has been believed to be favored by Khamenei, the supreme leader, in the last five or six elections have always lost. The people go out and they vote for the opposite candidate. This happened in 1997 when Khatami won. This happened in 2005 when Ahmadinejad won. It happened in 2009 when the Green Movement did win, but their elections were stolen. And remember, in 2013, most people believed that it was the very hardline nuclear negotiator, Saeed Jalili, who was favored by Khamenei, and he only got 11% of the vote. Rouhani crushed him.
Chuda Parsi is founder and president of the National Iranian American Council. Very interesting to see what happens. Chuda, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
The golden age of television on streaming platforms continues to get deeper and deeper. Besides Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon Prime, all web series show the power of filmmaking with just a few tools and some determined writers and directors. Melissa Locker, culture reporter for Time, The Guardian, and The Takeaway, has three to share. On the success of the web-to-TV hit Broad City, these are women's storylines and women heroes, and as Melissa explains, somewhat reluctant heroes and clearly not superheroes.
So one of the kind of most interesting and sort of buzzy new series is called Brown Girls.
Right.
It's about a friendship between a South Asian American writer and her African American musician girlfriend, which is based on the real life of the writer and director of the series. It's a really fun, engaging show about two people and two cultures that you don't see that much of on television.
Chill, you can't go to jail for punching someone.
Yeah, I'm brown. They're going to call me a terrorist.
Layla.
What, remember my cousin? The FBI wiretapped him. Remember?
Yeah, but your cousin was like hyper paranoid. Remember when I came over and he searched me to make sure I wasn't feeding information to the police?
Who's the audience for this?
I feel like it is definitely geared towards kind of a younger demographic, but I think anyone can honestly watch it as long as you're, you know, okay with a little like sexuality and some rough language. And it'll show you corners of the world that you may not necessarily see.
The formula for success on television. 86th, what's that all about?
So 86th comes from Cassie David. And if the last name sounds familiar, it's because her dad is Larry David of Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm. And I have to say that the apple does not fall very far from the tree. She's very dry. So she basically didn't have very much budget for the show, apparently, and right. So decided she needed to kind of do something that was all indoors. And she realized that one of the best ways to have someone just completely indoors would be either an invalid or going through a breakup. So she opted for breakup. And so she sits on her bed and kind of mopes. It's hard to win a breakup because it's not really something that you win.
So he probably already saw them. So I'm thinking the best thing for us to do in this situation is for me to tag a bunch of other people in the same post so it looks like you got hacked.
I'm not doing that. People will think I'm crazy.
Well, to be fair, you made everyone think I'm crazy, so.
You're being dramatic.
You're being really selfish.
And the show is very fun. It's a little bit dark, very dry. But if you're a fan of Curb Your Enthusiasm or shows like Girls, you're definitely going to find something to enjoy with this.
All right, Kate of the Damned. That sounds a little more action adventure and maybe out of a single room.
Yes. Do you know Megan Amram?
I don't know Megan Amram.
She was a writer for Parks and Recreation, and she's a writer for The Good Place. And she apparently had piloted a series that never really went anywhere, and so they turned it into a web series. It's kind of a cross between Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Underworld, where she's kind of this party girl who goes out to a club one night and gets bitten by a vampire. And she wakes up the next day and finds out that not only is she a vampire, which is annoying enough, but she's the queen of the vampires. And it's really harsh in her vibe, and she is just not interested in reigniting wars with werewolves or, you know, being in charge of all these minions.
The werewolves have struck the first blow. I am sorry, my queen, but this is an act of war. They have taken the heads of our proudest warriors. It is as much an assault as it is an insult.
Couldn't you just take a pic of the heads and text it to me like a normal person?
She just wants to, you know, go back to her normal life.
All right, so those are the three. Remind us of the titles.
So there's Kate of the Damned, 86th, and Brown Girls, and they are all available online right now.
Melissa Locker, culture reporter for Time, The Guardian, and The Takeaway. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Have you ever seen a commie drink a glass of water?
What?
Why do you want a little bit? Because if you're going to drink, I'd rather you do it in the house.
Why do you think I'm calling you? Just to say hello?
Did you see the memo about this?
And you won't be angry?
I will not be angry.
This is healthy. This is good.
And on this Friday, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, is with us. Let's begin with The Lovers.
Yeah, this is a small film by Azazel Jacobs. It stars Tracy Letts and Deborah Winger as a middle-aged married couple who are cheating, having affairs. But once they decide to actually split the sheet, something strange happens. They begin to get interested in each other again. Their desire rekindles, and suddenly they find themselves having affairs with each other on their affairs. It's a comedy. It's a drama. It's very interesting. These are two very complicated, strange characters. It's a little hard to get to know them, but it's a really interesting film. Never goes quite where you think. Just when you're laughing, something bitter and brutal will happen. Keeps you on your toes. I really enjoy this movie.
Well, that sounds like a positive. Not to be said for Diary of a Wimpy Kid, The Long Haul. This is something for the family.
That's right. This is the fourth installment in the series. I've always been a big fan of these movies based on Jeff Kinney's books. And I like the
love
way
the books.
Yeah, I love the books too. And so do my kids. And I like the central character, Greg Heffley, this deeply flawed, selfish kid who has to learn how to be good. That always struck me as very realistic. And these movies were always saccharine free. In this one, Greg is going to join his family for a road trip to see grandma. But of course, his real plan is to escape and attend a video game convention.
Everyone, hand over your devices.
You tricked us!
This is totally not cool.
You want me to read? I'm reading text. What's the difference?
A scene repeated in many households across America.
Yes, indeed. If you are a fan of these movies, you may have been able to detect that the entire cast has been replaced. Every single person is gone and replaced by a new actor. The original kid is now in college. He's too old to play this role anymore. The actors are okay. I think my problem with this film is it's a lot of bathroom humor. And I feel like that's not really what the Wimpy Kids movies are about. I think maybe they're trying to finally connect with their audience by kind of pandering a little bit. It didn't really work for me, and I think this is the weakest film in the series.
Nostalgia and horror is what Alien Covenant is all about. I can't resist this movie. It was one of the first, you know, sort of modern CGI films that I ever saw. It totally blew me away. Ridley Scott is back as director. Let's just listen.
I heard about these crazy bugs just outside this colonial pub scene. Apparently they look like cockroaches the size of a giant poodle.
Okay, first of all, stop, because I'm trying to eat.
Oh, come on, this is barely food.
But I love it.
Like you, I love the original Alien. To me, this series is getting a little repetitive, and I think it's losing its focus a bit. It's the same thing. A ship lands on a planet. The aliens are on the planet. The aliens attack. Everybody gets killed. The one twist here in this film is Michael Fassbender playing a dual role. He plays two androids, David from the last film, Walter, a new model. Little bit too much Fassbender in this film. He talks a lot to himself, fights himself. At one scene, he kisses himself. At that point, I kind of started to giggle a little bit, and I think giggling is not what you want from an alien film.
How about the aliens themselves? Any difference there?
I mean, they're a little more humanoid in some scenes, but this is, again, like I say, that sort of standard slasher body count formula.
Dripping mouth.
The dripping jaws, yeah. The whole bit. Shower scene, girl in the shower, gotta have that. I just feel like this film has kind of lost a little bit of its focus. The series itself, I think, is not holding up for me.
What's Covenant supposed to mean?
That's the name of the ship. That's the name of the colony ship that arrives on the planet.
I had some idea that they actually made a deal with the aliens. And
no, it's about as relevant as Prometheus was, the title of the last one.
That's right. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Have a great summery spring weekend.
I will, John. You too.
We talked with Senator John McCain at the beginning of the hour, and you know, go ahead, play it. Play it again.
And I believe that pigs are flying.
That reminded me of the moment in 1974, after months and months of Watergate investigations, when outspoken Arizona lawmaker Senator Barry Goldwater and two other congressional leaders went to the White House. They told President Nixon in blunt language that the country needed to move on. His support in Washington had vanished. His situation was hopeless. Nixon announced his resignation the very next evening. Well, Senator McCain made it sound like it would be way too soon for something like that. But might this Arizona senator and Trump critic eventually decide to repeat history someday? He did say pigs could fly. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.